next case for argument is City of Jackson versus Inc., A250135. Council, I know you're both familiar with our timing and procedures. And 5 minutes for your rebuttal. Council, for respondent, you will also have 15 minutes for your argument. The podium is adjustable, so feel free to get settled in and adjust it to the comfortable height. The buttons are sort of right on the underneath center there, so you can feel free to get settled in. Please state your name before you begin your argument and who you represent for purposes of our recording. And counsel for appellant, take your time getting settled in, but when you're ready, you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Joseph Langle from Ratwick, Rozak, and Maloney. I am here on behalf of the City of Jackson this morning. The issue before you today is whether the statute of limitations in 541.051 applies in a case where there's no injury to property. 541.051 is a very common statute of limitations that construction litigators deal with. It is the statute that applies in the vast majority of construction defect cases. The statute requires four things. It requires an improvement to real property. It requires that improvement had within it a defective and unsafe condition of some kind, that that condition cause an injury to property or to a person, and that that injury cause monetary damages. So four elements. If any of those are missing, then 541.051 does not apply. Here, as you know, we're dealing with a lift station. A lift station is basically an underground pump, right? It takes sewage. The sewage system is usually gravity-fed as much as possible, but at some point, topography requires it goes uphill. And so cities put in these lift stations. They're deep. They can be very deep. There's pumps at the bottom. The pumps pump up the sewage to a higher elevation, and from there it goes back down by gravity. These lift stations are an incredibly important part of these systems. If they don't work properly, the sewage doesn't flow, which causes big problems. The City of Jackson has a bad history of sewage problems. Their sewage system overflowed.
Council, we're familiar with the facts and how the system works, and I appreciate the background, but there are a number of questions that I would like to ask at least. And first, you mentioned no injury to property. How do you define injury to property?
Something had to have been damaged from the defective and unsafe condition. So in this case, we have pumps. If the pumps were defective in some fashion, or the design was defective in some fashion, that could give rise to burst pipes. It could give rise to sewage flowing out of the lift station, which in turn causes damage to the surrounding property, can cause personal injury because of the sewage. That's your injury. In this case,
What case would you rely on to argue that there has to be physical damage to the property for there to be injury to property?
Well, the statute itself talks about injury to property.
Well, injury does not necessarily equate to physical damage. In the Griebel case, the Supreme Court recognized a diminution in value to property, value to equate to injury to property. So I'm wondering why, what legal authority you have to suggest that injury to property equates to physical damage, which it seems that you're arguing.
I respectfully disagree that that's what the Griebel case says. So in Griebel, the Court of Appeals, according to this opinion, indicated that replacement cost for those defective patio doors were the damages. And then in the Supreme Court decision, it says, a reading of the plaintiff's complaint demonstrates that they seek damages not only for the patio doors, as suggested by the Court of Appeals, but also for the loss and diminution of market value of the home. I read that as a remark on damages, not a holding that diminution of value is somehow an injury to property. Diminution in value is an injury to the owner. It's a financial harm. The property is now worth less. The rest of this opinion doesn't talk about injury to property at all. In fact, the entire opinion was focused on defective and unsafe.
Griebel talks about that plaintiff's complaint seeks damages not only for replacement costs of the patio doors suggested by the Court of Appeals, but also for loss and diminution of market value of the home, which you noted, to fall within the scope of the injury to property, real or personal provision. So the court is equating the market value to fall within the scope of injury to property, real or personal, as I read it. But help me understand why you're reading it differently and why you think
sure. I think it's a terribly worded sentence, to be honest. The sentence starts out talking about what are damages here. The last phrase, to fall within the scope of the injury to property, real or person, I take that to mean that the injury here, whatever that is, that affect the broken doors, that the flies coming into the home, that the diminution of market value falls within and is related to that injury. It's not that diminution of market value is an injury. That's not a property. That's not an injury to the property. That's an injury to the property owner, that they have less value in their property because of what occurred with the infestation of flies and so forth.
What I would also, then was the injury to the property in Griebel, in your view?
This case never expressly discussed injury to property, as is the case with...
It's more focused on what is a defective and unsafe condition.
Correct. Most of these cases...
But it does have that language above, which is... that we just discussed. So then going back to my original question, what case would you cite us to support your narrow reading of injury to property as limited to physical damage to property? Because as you noted at the beginning of your argument, that provision 051 has been applied in the expansively or interpreted broadly to apply to construction cases.
I don't think that it's been interpreted broadly. I think what I said was...
you're right. I added that piece. But
Usually applied...
You noted it has been applied in the vast majority of cases, construction cases.
Right. And some of these cases cited by a respondent, just talk about physical injuries to property, flooding, erosion, property damage. That's a capital supply case. Surface water flooding in the Ocel case. The Nolan case, frequent flooding. Delano case, we got sagging sewer pipes, which froze because of the sagging.
Do any of those cases really get at what is an injury to property? In other words, going back to my original question, what legal support do you have for your interpretation?
Most of these cases do not, because the injury is assumed or it's apparent. The cases focus not on the injury to property. Most of these cases focus on the timing element of 541.051, which is the most common problem.
What is the legal authority for your interpretation of injury to property?
The language of the statute itself, which requires a injury to property, real or personal, or bodily injury or wrongful death that arises out of some defective and unsafe condition. Before that, it says recover damages for any injury. Diminution in value is a damage. If my property is worth $500,000 before something happened, it's worth $400,000 now, I've had diminution of value. That's the damage.
What's the difference between damage and injury? Isn't it the same thing?
not in this statute. The way that this was written was four parts. You have to recover damages for an injury to property, personal or real, personal injury, out of a defective condition during an improvement.
Under the diminution in value is an injury, what you recover is the money to compensate you for that. Doesn't that make sense?
I think what that does is it conflates two different terms. I'm sorry, what?
Wouldn't under that scenario with a diminution in value, aren't the damages the money you recover?
The damages are the money that you recover, the diminution in value. Not that diminution in value applies in our case.
But then the diminution in value has to be the injury which leads to the damages, correct?
The injury was the flooding. The injury was the flies coming in. Those are the injuries.
Well, then in this case, do you even have is your claim even ripe if there is no physical damage?
No, not if I was bringing a claim for negligence under 541.051. That's the whole point. We're not bringing a claim, a typical construction defect claim. We're not bringing it. We're not bringing it because we have no injury. We could wait until those pumps fail.
Except in your complaint, you allege that in paragraph 13 on page 3 of your complaint that the defects adversely affect the city's ongoing use of the sanitary system, giving rot. So you're alleging that there's already an impact that gives rise to increased maintenance costs and replacement costs and reduce the projected lifespan and value of the system. So in your complaint, you allege a decrease in value to the system and ongoing maintenance costs.
But I never allege, or the city never alleged, any injury to the property.
Isn't
nothing
that
has
the
happened
injury?
At this point.
Isn't reduction in value of the system? The system is the property, correct?
The system is the property and it's working, yes.
And you're saying the value of the system has been reduced as a result of BMI's professional engineering recommendations in paragraph 13. That's
the value of what we paid for it is not worth what we paid for it because they gave us something that violates engineering standards.
But you also alleged in the complaint that there were increased costs and ongoing maintenance costs. Isn't that the injury?
Discovery hasn't shown any ongoing maintenance costs from this, but in any event, that's not the injury.
Well, but that's part of your complaint, and this is a grant of summary judgment, so we have to look at the
I understand.
Facts in light most favorable to you, including the complaint to the city of Jackson, and that is part of that allegation to support the claim. That seems to go to the injury that has occurred to the city of Jackson.
The city's position is that and we've said this from the beginning, that the lift station is working. Okay? We've never had a problem with it like we had before when we've had all these sewage flow issues outside the stations. The pumps are working, the impellers are working, the valves are working, it's all working. The claim that we brought is a professional malpractice claim because the design was wrong. And we've had two independent engineering firms tell us that the design is absolutely improper for what it should have been. Those pumps are grossly undersized. The lift station should have been designed differently. In a case, 541.051 was never intended to encompass a situation where what was built works, but the design is wrong as a matter of engineering duty. There are standards that must be followed for lift stations. They're called the 10-state standards. When you design these things, you have to take into account certain things. inflow, infiltration, future growth, all these things, none of that was taken into account. Those pumps should have been at 3,500 gallons per minute. They're at 2,000 at best.
Why wasn't that put in the contract in between the city and the engineer?
I'm sorry, why was it?
The specification, it seems like you're trying to backdoor a breach of contract.
You have a contract to build this
system, and it's not up to specs. And why wasn't that information included in the contract in the first place?
The 10 state standards, the professional standards for engineering, I've never seen those in specifications for this type of project. That's what they're required to follow under state law, but it's not, we're not trying to backdoor a breach of contract claim, which I, you know, also would have a 6-year statute of limitations. It's two things. It's a professional malpractice because they should have known better when they designed this thing, and a misrepresentation claim.
But your complaint doesn't allege breach of contract.
Correct. It's the complaint is a pure, it's two things. It's the professional malpractice and misrepresentation. And misrepresentation is fraud, which eliminates the 2-year statute of limitations in the first place. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And you will have 5 minutes for your rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, when you're ready, feel free to adjust the podium, get settled in, and state your name and who you represent for the record.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Steve Buterin, and I'm here on behalf of Bolton Mink to ask that this court affirm the district court's decision dismissing the city's claims as time-barred under Minnesota Statute 541.051. There are a lot of problems with the city's claims. Simply put, the city is asking this court to adopt an interpretation of 541.051 that no other court has followed and that is contrary to the plain language of the statute.
What is the meaning of injury to property as used in 051?
The statute refers to any damage to property and the...
Or any injury to property.
Any injury to property. I apologize for misspeaking there. The injury would be damages that flow from a defective and unsafe condition in the property, whether it be the underlying property or the structure that might be built on top of the property itself. Nothing in the language of the statute confines or defines what is an injury to property.
So what meaning should we give to that language, injury to property?
I think, the statute prefaces this by saying any action in negligence or tort. The damages would be those that naturally flow from the defective and unsafe condition of the property. So if you had, like many of the cases we did cite involving municipal sewage and wastewater systems, those did involve discharges of water or sewage. That would constitute. But also, that's an obvious example. But if you, for example, had a building and the structural steel design was somehow defective and the building couldn't sustain the loads that ultimately it was designed for, that could be a defect to the property.
Is
much
a
like
diminution in the value of the property an injury to property?
Yes, I believe so. And Your Honor noted the Greibel decision. There, this court actually noted in the appeal before it that the plaintiffs in that case were not seeking damages to property. They weren't saying that the doors that let the flies in.
And when you say damages to property, you're talking about physical damage.
Right. And this court noted that And then the Supreme Court picked up on it and the language in the sentence that you pointed out to counsel. So the damages that are the injuries can be the loss of use, the diminution in value of the property, increased costs, provided that they relate to the defective and unsafe condition of the improvement to real property.
So
is there any evidence in this case of diminution in value?
There was only written discovery. There were no depositions. The damages that I focused on were those alleged in the city's complaint. And they talk about loss of value of the system, increased maintenance costs, what have you. And those, I think, are the claims that we need to evaluate because this is on summary judgment, so we need to look at what they are alleging. They're alleging in their complaint.
Summary judgment appropriate based solely on the allegations in the complaint without any evidence of diminution in value or increased maintenance costs?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
In other words, have you met your burden for summary judgment relying solely on the complaint without producing evidence of the diminution in market value or increased maintenance costs?
Well, yeah, I believe we have this. BMI has sustained its burden because we're defending. The city has the
can
burden.
Accept the court can accept those allegations as true on summary judgment.
I think on summary judgment, yes, the court could, and they tie back to the other provisions of the complaint or paragraphs in the complaint that state the loss of use, the increased cost, the loss of useful life, all are attributable to the allegedly defective design from BMI and that they flow naturally from it. And so assuming that those claims are true, you know, the loss of use, the increased maintenance costs, this case then falls within the scope of 541.051. And the city has
what
not...
What about appellant's argument that 051 was never intended to encompass a situation where the property's functioning, but there hasn't been any, you know, damage to the property itself?
I think that's pure speculation. There's nothing in the statute or the case law that's interpreted this statute. And this statute has been extensively litigated over decades. And no one has seemed to raise this argument ever.
But can you point us to any case other than Griebel where there's been a complaint where 051 has been applied to bar a complaint without actual physical damage to property?
I'm not aware of any. And I think the problem is that if you have no damages, you know, the city contracted for a lift station to move sewage, and that's precisely what they've gotten. There's no problem. They allege the city. It's the city's allegation. There are no problems with the system. Therefore, it's questionable whether they even have a viable claim, whether their claim is ripe. They are in their complaint seeking $50,000 for damages incurred. And I believe that's the language from the complaint. It says incurred. They've incurred $50,000 for what? They haven't articulated what their damages are, because in order to bring a professional malpractice claim, not only do you have to show duty and a breach of that duty, but you have to show that that professional breach of duty resulted in damages, and we don't have damages here. There are no damages. The city concedes repeatedly in their reply brief to this court, there are no damages. There's nothing wrong with the system. So that begs the question, why are we here? Why are they entitled to in excess of $50,000?
Well, counsel, your argument seems a little circular because, and this is where I'm struggling a little bit, because in order to have damages, you have to have some type of injury. And so if there are no damages, then it seems like there's no injury. If there's no injury, then it seems like appellants would prevail.
Well, the evidence in the record shows that on November 15th of 2019, they brought the lift station into service. And they realized at that point that there was, it was not meeting standards. And then the city retained an engineering expert to say that the city was under, or the system was under-designed. And then the city attorney wrote a letter to BMI saying that, you know, there's defects here. We believe we're entitled to damages. So I think there's evidence in the record that would lend support to the notion that there were damages that, you know, the their and their complaint also speaks of loss of use, lifespan, increased costs. And based on those allegations, that would be sufficient to trigger application of 541.051 because those claimed damages relate back to or flow from the allegedly defective design and unsafe condition of the lift station. The cases that we've cited, the Grable, Metropolitan Life, and SCH Nelson, all involved claims that did not result where there was no damage to property. A physical damage to property. And the one I'm most familiar with is Nelson versus SCH. That involved a sedimentation pond that was part of the city's stormwater treatment system. And the homeowners brought claims against the city of Stillwater for nuisance and loss of or diminution in value of the property. And this court held that, yes, indeed, based on those allegations, there were damages, and they applied 541.051 to rule that the homeowner's claims were untimely. And this is a little different. We have a lift station that allegedly was defectively designed, unsafe. And that has resulted in a loss of use, a diminution in value of the system. And it falls squarely within and comfortably within the language of 541.051.
The appellant also asserted negligent misrepresentation. And there is a carve out in the statute for fraud. And there's an allegation that before construction, BMI twice assured the city that the new lift station would be able to pump at 3,000. So why is that allegation of the misrepresentation not enough to fall within the fraud exception of the statute?
Because there's been no evidence or allegation that that BMI did anything to actively mislead the city.
Wouldn't that be a question for the fact finder?
Well, in this, the way Minnesota law has come down through case law is that the fraud exception dissipates once the plaintiff discovers its injury. And there's a distinction there that appears to be in the case law between claims on the 2-year statute of limitations portion of 541.051 and the 10-year statute of repose. And I'm not aware of any cases, and I certainly could be mistaken, and I don't want to misrepresent to the court, but I'm not aware of any cases myself that have applied the fraud exception to the 2-year statute of limitations. It seems that the case law has come down on that issue with regard to the 10-year statute of repose. And that's where it makes the most sense, because if you have fraud, the claim typically accrues, just generally for fraud claims, when the plaintiff discovers the fraud and So in this case, the fraud exception makes sense for the 10-year statute of repose, because if, for example, BMI was fraudulently representing or taking steps to mislead the city in terms of the capacity of the station, and it affected the 10-year statute of repose, that's where it would be. The statute says, because of this fraud, the statute of repose doesn't start until the fraud is discovered, and then you get your 10-year statute of repose.
So putting that in the facts of this case, if the fraud was discovered, you know, if they discovered the fraud when they first, you know, wrote the letter that said, you know, at probably even a little bit before that, so then why wouldn't that then fall within that? Because the it was discovered, then they later bring a complaint, it's still within the time frame of a fraud claim. So why wouldn't it take it out of the 541?
Well, if I understand correctly, the claim falls within 541.051 for the 2-year statute of limitations, but the fraud was discovered within that 10 years, and it was discovered early on. It was discovered within a week of the system coming online. I don't think I'm answered the question.
That was probably a bad question. You can go ahead.
I see that I'm running out of time, but I would like to conclude that the district court and Minnesota case law and the statute amply support the district court's decision that 541.051, the 2-year statute of limitation, applies to the city's claims, and they are untimely because the city knew well before 2 years, within 2 years, that it had an actionable claim. Yet despite that, it failed to bring suit within the time allowed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. And Counsel for Appellant, when you're ready, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just working backwards here, negligent misrepresentation, there is evidence in the record in the interrogatory responses where city staff stated under oath that they were told 3 times that BMI said there was going to be 3,000 gallons per minute pumps put in there. That is a misrepresentation because that's not what happened. And in terms of the limitations, the way that 541.051 works is that, in that first phrase, except for when fraud occurs, then it goes on with the 2-year statute of limitations. In those cases where fraud does occur, there is no 2-year statute of limitation. That whole first part of that statute is accepted out by the very terms of the statute.
So and that's what Whitmer was getting at. The case law, though, suggests that the exception essentially pauses the tolls the 10-year language that nor in any event shall a cause of action accrue more than 10 years after substantial completion of the construction, except where fraud is involved.
No, that goes back to the Whitmer case where the court said you can't toll something that has not yet occurred. Where there's fraud and it's hidden, it hasn't occurred, so there's nothing to toll. And the language of the statute itself doesn't say it's tolled. It says except where. It accepts it out. So you're left with, I mean, this is just the way the statute was written. You're left with the 10-year statute of repose in those situations. I also want to point out two other things quickly here. We stopped this case in mid-discovery, okay? There's been no professional engineering affidavit submitted at this point. We had the initial one, but the actual affidavit has not been submitted. There's been no depositions of anybody in this case. To the extent there are any fact questions arising out of this discussion, we should have the absolute right to go back and finish that discovery and have all those facts in hand before being thrown out of this case. We did this in order to save extensive amounts of cost dealing with expert witnesses because of the assertion that, well, we've got a statute of limitations argument and we should deal with that first. Well, fine, but if if, like I said, it involves facts that have not yet been, ascertained in this case, then we should continue on with that process instead of having it interrupted halfway and then suffering the injury of dismissal, basically dismissal on the pleadings, when that is not fair or appropriate.
Well, but it seems to be primarily a legal issue, especially when summary judgment. We are looking at the facts as alleged in light most favorable to city here. But going to the statute, I wanted to touch on one other part, because I noticed when you cited the statute, you start with the accept part, but then you left out the part that says no action by any person in contract, tort, or otherwise. And I think that's important, because that seems to be fairly broad language that would seem to encompass this, as well as other similar construction cases.
Except where fraud is involved.
Right. When you cited the statute in your brief, you cite that part, but then you had the ... for the no action by any person in contract, tort, or otherwise. And that's fairly broad language there as to what is encompassed by the section.
I would agree, to the extent that it is not then narrowed by the language that comes behind it, right? If you're recovering damages for an injury arising out of a defective, unsafe condition that was caused by an improvement.
You're not arguing that there wasn't a defective or unsafe condition. You're only arguing that there wasn't an injury to property, as I read your brief.
We feel that the design was defective, yes. And that's what the outside engineers are telling us. The design is defective.
The issue here is whether there's an injury to property that brings your claims within the scope of 051.
Whether it brings our current malpractice and misrepresentation claims within the scope. Mm-hmm. As I started saying before, you can always wait until it breaks, and then the two-year starts clicking, assuming you're within the 10-year statute of repose, right? Sure. Didn't want to do that. We've got a history here, a bad history with these pumps, and we didn't want to wait until we had effluent going into the Des Moines River. That's why we have professional malpractice claims. That's why we have misrepresentation claim. And one final point, the diminution of market value was the term used in these cases, like the Greibel case. There is no market value to a sewage pump. There isn't. There is no market for sewage pumps, which is why we stated in the brief that even if it were applicable as a term of injury, it does not apply here.
I have one more quick question for you, if you don't mind. Respondent argues that we should look to Nelson v. Short, Elliott, Hendrickson, and that case is instructive as to whether or not there's an injury here, and that can you respond to that argument in terms of the sedimentation pond at issue there and in Nelson, and whether that's...
So Nelson was a sedimentation pond on an easement on somebody's private property, dead muskrats, dead fish, stunk like a cesspool. The court never addressed issues like whether there's an injury to property or person. Never addressed it. Instead, the court focused, as they often do, on the two-year timing issue as to whether any claims could be based on what the complaints were from the property owner. Courts don't always go into every single element if one of them is obviously not going to work. And in that case, the court said, hey, folks, you knew way more than 2 years ago that there were problems here. So regardless of whether it's an injury or damages, you're untimely.
You have to have an injury to property for that two-year, for you to, your knowledge to be a bar of a claim. So, and the case does discuss discovery of injuries. But we'll go back and look closely at that. But your view is that case doesn't really address what is an injury.
Correct. It never analyzed whether dead muskrats constitute an injury.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Please. Yeah, we've got another question for you.
Sorry.
You're in demand. I just had one final question. In your complaint, you alleged damages of over $50,000, tying it to the maintenance costs, ongoing maintenance costs, and other increased costs. In order to support that damages claim, though, doesn't there have to be an injury?
The injury is the design. We're going to have to spend six figures fixing this design. What we've been told is we can't use that system. It can't be just expanded. You have to replace it or put another one next to it. It physically can't just, you can't just put 120 horsepower pumps in there. So you're looking at six figures worth of new work to fix the defect, which was the design of this thing. We're supposed to have 3,000, 3,500, and you've got a little less than 2,000. That's the defect. That's the cost. That's what the city is looking at. That's why this complaint was brought.
Great. Thank you, Council. Thank you to both Council for your arguments today and for your briefs. It was helpful. The case is submitted, and we will get an opinion out within the statutory time frame. Thank you.